Is cannabis bad for your heart?
How PET imaging in cognitive decline?
Can CT help in declaring brain death?
And addictive screen use patterns in adolescent mental health.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn first to JAMA, this look at, gosh, what is that screen time doing to our adolescence anyway?
We've reported before on total screen time. I'm talking about screen time using things like social media and media games and mobile iPhones and how it's been related to behavioral health, depression, social isolation. But what we haven't really talked about is the patterns of screen use. What these investigators did, they tried to identify the different trajectories of what they call addictive use of social media, mobile phones, and also video games, whether these different trajectories influence either suicidal behaviors or suicidal ideation, and then also mental health outcomes among young adults. They were able to do this because there's an ongoing study called the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study that's been going on since 2016. They assess the screen use and the trajectory of screen use at baseline at years 2, 3, and 4. Surprisingly, 31% had increasing addictive use trajectories, and it was clearly associated with an increased suicidal ideation and suicidal behavior as well. There's a high and increasing use of social media, mobile phones, and video games, and it's clearly associated with poor outcomes. Screen time wasn't associated with these things, so it wasn't the amount of time they were spending, it's the trajectory.
I'd sure like to have a lot more data about, was it the video games? Does that result in more suicidal ideation? Is it bullying on social media? Does that result in more suicidal ideation? I think that those details are really important.
You're right. When we talk about social media, they weren't able, at least for this particular study, to tease out exactly how they were spending their time doing it.
Was there any difference between males and females with regard to these trajectories?
Yeah, there was. Interesting that you bring it up, because it appears that the females were more affected with the social media. In fact, were more likely to be involved with social media. The guys were the ones that were most likely to be involved with video games. But among the social media users, the young adolescent girls were more affected than the young adolescent boys.
And clearly, then, this begs the question of intervention.
Right. The editorialist suggests some certain things. We need to enforce a minimum age requirement for most social media platforms. It's really not very well enforced. They mentioned that about 2/3 of participants younger than 13 years of age already use social media.
Speaking of things that we really need to pay some attention to, let's turn to the BMJ, their heart journal. This is a meta-analysis of cardiovascular risk that's associated with the use of cannabis and cannabinoids, which, as we know, just like social media, are out there in increasing numbers of all different types, and more people appear to be using them. As we know here domestically, there has been a lot of legalization of recreational use and then other types of ostensible medicinal use. This meta-analysis looks at the relationship between major adverse cardiovascular events and the use of cannabis or cannabinoids. And in their MACE designation, they use cardiovascular death, non-fatal acute coronary syndrome, including MIs or non-fatal stroke. They ultimately ended up with 24 articles. And what they found was that if you were exposed to cannabis, whether that was ostensibly medical or you were smoking it, or you were using some of these products, your risk ratio for acute coronary syndrome was 1.29, 1.20 for stroke, and 2.10 for cardiovascular death. In view of the fact that we're seeing many more people, including older people who already may have a lot of comorbidities, using cannabis, says to me anyway, more scrutiny required and a lot more regulation.
Yeah, this is a really well done study. As the authors mentioned, it appears to be the first meta-analysis that examined the potential association of cannabis use and major adverse cardiac events. And it really reflects the real world scenario of how cannabis is used. The data are pretty consistent because it's not just a single major cardiac event. Each of them individually and totally increased with cannabis use.
The authors suggest that there is a mechanism that might be associated with why cannabis use has this negative impact on the cardiovascular system. It points to associations with oxidative stress, tissue injury, cell death. It's also pro-atherogenic, pro-fibrotic, and pro-inflammatory. And it results in this vasodilation, vasoconstriction in the sympathetic nervous system that could also put additional stress on the cardiovascular system.
Those are all plausible explanations. The other thing is, remember that most of the cannabis use is done via smoking. And so it may not be the cannabis itself, it may be something in the smoke. So there's more to be done and try to figure out exactly what the underlying mechanism behind this.
Would you agree with me that it's something that probably needs to be regulated?
I would agree. And it's becoming more potent, by the way. That's why identifying whether it's the cannabis, the THC, cannabinoids, or some other constituent in the smoke. But at this particular point, unfortunately, it's very much like alcohol. And we have the opportunity to regulate cannabis use. And as you mentioned, we've not done it in a way that preserves the health of the populations. The other thing I'd mention is that these studies were done primarily in adults. And we know that cannabis use, particularly in youngsters or adolescents, can change the neural outcome of the individuals.
Back to JAMA for your next one.
Tau PET imaging. In people that have Alzheimer's type symptoms, we use PET imaging to detect amyloid plaques, AB plaques. There are some individuals that have AB plaques that never go on to develop neurologic symptoms. So there's another protein, and these are called neurofibrillary tangles. We detect them with what's called tau PET imaging. Since the amyloid imaging sometimes doesn't predict who will develop cognitive decline, does the tau imaging provide us different information? And what percentage of the normal population would have tau? And is it an early marker of dementia? They had a longitudinal cohort study of over 6,500 participants. About 1 in 10 of these cognitively unimpaired individuals had positive tau PET scans. That frequency increased with age. So, for example, if you're 90 or 95 years old, as many as 70% of individuals without cognitive impairment can have positive tau PET scanning. About 90% of the people that have tau imaging positive also had amyloid imaging positive, and they were more likely to develop cognitive impairment over the next 5 years, as many as 70%. This study underscores the potential role of tau PET imaging as a biomarker for staging Alzheimer's disease across the spectrum of dementia.
As you know, the FDA has just approved a blood test for biomarkers that ostensibly point to the presence of both tau and beta amyloid in the CNS. I think that the employment of techniques like this one are kind of interesting from a research standpoint, but are probably going to be obviated by the practical nature of being able to do something in someone's peripheral blood to pinpoint the presence of these things, just as this study does.
That's one possibility. What the imaging will provide is not only the presence, but also the extent of tau protein. When you're able to see on a PET imaging, it's usually at advanced stages, what I call stages 5 and 6. It can be present in very early stages, but not enough to be seen by neuroimaging. This study looked at the more advanced stage 5 and 6 pathology findings that one would expect and the tau imaging associated with that. So the detection in blood may not provide the whole story. You may need to figure out both the extent and also where it's located in the brain as well.
However, I would also suggest to you that we do know that as Alzheimer's disease progresses, it impacts on very predictable areas of the brain as it goes forward. I would also say I still come back to the same place, which is sort of a yes, and until we have something that's really effective to interrupt this, I wouldn't go out there wholesale employing PET, which isn't all that available anyway to do this assessment.
You're right. I think this is, again, a part of the understanding of the mechanisms. Until we understand those underlying mechanisms, we won't be able to do that. So I agree with you. You could argue that if the blood test is negative for amyloid and tau, you don't need to go any further. I think that's fair. You could also argue that once it's detectable, that maybe one should do imaging to detect how widespread it is. And that could provide some prognostic information and hopefully some therapeutic information in the future.
That is to be hoped. Finally, let's turn to JAMA Neurology, and this is the use of CT perfusion and angiography for assisting people to declare death by neurologic criteria. As you know, I do a lot of work in critical care units, and I've watched clinicians really struggle with this notion of declaring death by neurologic criteria. This is a very tough role to have to take on. Can we assist and help to really nail down the fact that this is the correct determination to make by using CT? This was a study that took place in 15 adult intensive care units across Canada. Used contrast-enhanced brain CT perfusion with CT angiography reconstructions. Within 2 hours of a blinded, standardized clinical death by neurologic criteria examination, they had independent neuroradiologists who were blinded to the clinical findings, and they had a pre-specified validation threshold greater than 98%. They had a total of 282 patients. 204 of these were ultimately declared deceased by standardized clinical criteria. This qualitative brainstem CT perfusion had a sensitivity of 98.5% and a specificity of 74.4%. The qualitative whole brain CT perfusion yielded a sensitivity of 93.6% and a specificity of 92.3%. So, did not meet the pre-specified threshold.
Yeah, and as you highlight, Elizabeth, you want the test to be spot on. You don't want to have a false positive test where you're erroneously declaring someone's dead and donating the organs when they're not. And you don't want a false negative test. You're prolonging this futile organ support. These tests don't achieve that, so you can't use them as standalone tests, but they can provide ancillary support.
I'm sure that they're going to think of something that's going to be able to be added to this that probably will be more informative. I think a piece of comforting information from this study is that the authors say no patient declared deceased by neurologic criteria was alive at hospital discharge. To me, that says yes, those clinical impressions really are spot on, and that while this is a difficult decision, nobody was in the unfortunate situation of being declared dead, but in fact, they were alive.
Yeah. Again, this is a very well done study. I think it provides good support, but you can't do away with the physical exam. You can't do away with the clinical acumen and say, oh, we're just going to order a test and that will tell us the whole story, because this study suggests that it doesn't.
On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.